One of the fundamental mitzvahs of Yom Kippur, which often is forgotten about when we talk about everything else about Yom Kippur, is the mitzvah of tshuva. So part of the obligation of tshuva is that a person is supposed to go, and halacha it says that throughout the Aseres Yemei tshuva, and particularly in Yom Kippur, which is the day where of tshuva, like the Rambam explains how Yom Kippur is dafka, the prime time of tshuva, that halacha is, halacha in Shulchan Aruch as well, that a person has to go and search through his actions, l'mashmash b'maisav, and do tshuva naseres yemei tshuva, and in Yom Kippur. And as Rabbeinu Yonah writes, and it's brought down in halacha as well, that there's certain avedas that we know for sure that we've done, there's certain avedas that are what we call a safik aveda, that we're not sure. And the halacha is that a safik aveda requires more tshuva than an aveda v'adois. There's a joke that people always say that why is there no hilchas tshuva in Shulchan Aruch, it's only in Rambam, because Rambam included even the halacha that are not negay nowadays. So, but it's not exactly accurate that saying, because we do have hilchas tshuva in Shulchan Aruch, not the whole entire sefer hilchas tshuva, but it's mentioned in hilchas Yom Kippur. So we need to take into account what we've done, and that includes also these people that we've mistreated throughout the year. Part of the halacha is that we're supposed to ask forgiveness of them before Yom Kippur. It's not only a matter of just actually saying the words, I beg forgiveness, but the halacha is that aveda should be not amal chaveroi. Yom Kippur is not mechaper. Things that are between man and another man, between individuals, Yom Kippur cannot atone achi yiratzas chaveroi, unless a person seeks forgiveness. So therefore, even if a person was maknet bidvarim, even if he only verbally told of someone else, part of the obligation of pre-Yom Kippur to make sure that we have a proper mechila is to be mefayis, to appease, and you meant to actually specify the chet, tell the person, I wronged you in this and this way, this is what I did. The only time you're not supposed to specify the sin that you did against someone else is the other person will become embarrassed when you do that. Otherwise, you're supposed to specify that, and that is part of the kapara of Yom Kippur. Also, we're told about Aseres Mechuv in Yom Kippur, that we should be careful in different inyanim chumris. There's certain chumris that throughout the year maybe we're not so particular, but when it comes Aseres Mitzvah, then we're much more particular, especially when it comes to matters associated with kashrus. Hataras Nadarim is usually done Erev Rosh Hashanah, but if a person missed out Aseres Erev Rosh Hashanah, they could do that in Aseres Mitzvah as well. And I'll mention one more thing before we get to the actual Erev Yom Kippur. There's halachas associated with sukkahs, but a lot of the stuff about sukkahs, it's a good idea. Zrizim Agdimul Mitzvahs, you want to chaparayim mitzvahs before Yom Kippur. So we already, it says we should already buy our dal d'minim before Yom Kippur too, unless we think that we might find more mehudadiga dal d'minim after Yom Kippur. Obviously, we make sure that our dal d'minim is 100% kosher. There's no questions of murkav or esrog being grafted with another type. We make sure they're mehudah. We make sure the people that we're buying from people that we can rely on. And all the other lachs associated with dal d'minim. Same with the sukkah, it could be done after Yom Kippur. There's a minute to do a matzah Yom Kippur, but in some ways it's always better to prepare ourselves in advance, at least make the proper preparations. Let's move on to Erev Yom Kippur, the Seder of Erev Yom Kippur. So this year, Erev Yom Kippur starts on Masa Shabbos, which is a bit different than normal. The routine is pretty much the same, but just a bit different because it's on Masa Shabbos following Sunday. So on Masa Shabbos, normally we do the process of Kaparis, unless people do it earlier. And there's a number of questions that we were asked in association with kaparas. So the minig is that a woman that's expecting uses three chickens, two female chickens and one male. There is an opinion that a bunch of people can use one kaparas together, but there's another opinion that says that every individual needs his own atonement. So if a woman is expecting, she needs one for herself, one for the child, and an entire sikh of the Rebbe. The fetus needs a kapara if he wasn't born yet, we'll leave that for right now. And since the child could either be a male or a female, so therefore there's one female for the mother, one female for one option of the child, the fetus might be a female, and one male because it might be a male, that's three. Now, the question was asked, what if today's day and age, sometimes it happens that a woman that's expecting knows the gender of the baby, does she still have to do three? Now, generally, we try not to know the gender of the baby. This is based on the Medrash, that there's certain things that Hashem keeps hidden from man, and one of them is the gender. But there are cases where, for whatever reason, they do know the gender. So I'll bring up a different question, which is somewhat related, then we'll go back to this question. the question was asked in the Poskim, why do we take three? Why don't we take five? Maybe they're twins. And it could be twin male, twin female, or one male, one female. And the Poskim says she doesn't have to worry that she has twins because it's lo shchiach. It's not very common. It's not common that that there's twins. And we're talking about a minig, after all. So we don't have to worry about the far-fetched chance that in case there's twins. The question that the Rebbe asks is, and that was also one of the questions that were asked, nowadays people do know that they have twins. There's various different things that people test that people do, including ultrasounds, where they can advance, know that they have twins. So the Rebbe raises this question, and the Rebbe doesn't answer. So it reminds me of a story that there was once a group of Bachrim Yeshiva Tev Chetvim, and amongst the Bachrim, there was one Bachrim which was a very simple Bachrim, not very learned at all. And he told his friends, I'm going to go to the Ragachover, and I'm going to ask him a question, and the Ragachover, going, the genius of the time, is not going to know the answer. So he said, what, you're going to ask a question, the Ragachover will know the answer? He said, yeah. So he walks in with a few other Bachrim to the Ragachover, and he says, I have a question. Why does the Siddur start with Shachos, continues with Minch, and continues with Ma'ariv? And the Mishnayos and the Gemara, we start with evening, Shema of the evening, and then Shema of the morning, the opposite order. So why is there a difference? And the Ragachover said, I don't know. I don't know the answer. So the Bacher comes out, and the Bacher says, you see, I knew the Ragachover won't know the answer. So the other Bacherim told him, yeah, but how did you know? It's very simple. I was by Fabringen, and the Rebbe Rashab asked this very question, and he didn't answer it. And I know a question that the Rebbe asks, and he doesn't answer, that no one else can answer it. That's what this simple Bacher said. Incidentally, the Rebbe actually once did speak about this topic, why the Shulchan Aruch and the Siddur have a different order. So going back to our topic at hand, the Rebbe raises a question, the Rebbe doesn't answer. If the Rebbe doesn't answer, there's no way that I could answer the question. The two sides that the Rebbe gives, on the one hand, she's done testing, and she knows there's an ultrasound, and it's something that we rely on, that she has twins. We rely on when it comes to Pikuach Nefesh, when it comes to Shabbos, when it comes to Yom Kippur. It's something which is halachically considered a valid, that even though not all ultrasounds are accurate, but generally it's considered a bitter clarification. On the other hand, after all, we're talking about a minig. We're talking about something which is not common. We're talking about something which is, there is an opinion that says that many people anyhow could use one kapara. So to be so far-fetched because you happen to know she has twins, who says you have to go that far? The Rebbe leaves the question blank and doesn't answer the question, so I'm not going to volunteer an answer to. One thing I will say is that if somebody chooses to be machmer because the Rebbe allows for that option, that's a great idea, and take extra for the twins. And if somebody chooses to decide, listen, it's a bother, it's a tircha, it's not common, you know, I don't have to worry because I happen to know that I have twins based on ultrasound, I'm not going to worry about it. There are opinions that say you can use one kapara for everyone. They're also on safe grounds because they follow what the Rebbe said. So that's in regard to the question that was asked, what do you do if we know she's pregnant with twins? It's a question that the Rebbe leaves unanswered. But the question about if a woman knows the actual gender, so although they're modern contemporary poskim that question asked this question, it seems like that the Rebbe's position would be pretty clear. The Rebbe says that ultrasound we consider it a proper bir. So if a woman has clear information based on ultrasound, whether it's a male or female, there's really no reason to go and do and take extra kaparas, you should only need two kaparas. Further about kaparas, what stage is a woman considered pregnant when it comes to kaparas? So under 40 days, there's really no reason to be concerned. According to halacha, pregnancy under 40 days, we call it mayo ba'alma. It's not really considered a fetus. And if in this case, it wouldn't be a need for extra kaparas. After 40 days, then there should be extra kaparas. Now, sometimes it's embarrassing to do kaparas for three chickens at once, or it's hard, never mind embarrassing, which is simply complicated. So you don't have to do them all at once. You can do one, and then the second one, and the third, that's fine. If the chicken wasn't shechted properly, what do you do then? So this is a very important question, because often by kaparas, a lot of places can talk about this, that by kaparas that we find a lot of problems with the shechita. And we've improved a lot since the olden days, in some ways, and some days we've regressed. We've improved a lot. Our standards of shechita and kashrus are much higher in some ways. On the other hand, everything is commercialized. We have so many people coming to kaparas. So we're not living in a shtetl, we're living in a city. So, and it's fast-paced. And when the Sheikhtim are shechting a lot at once, we always want the Sheikhtim not to shech that much at once, to slow down, to take breaks. One of the most important things in a Shechita is how often do the Sheikhtim take breaks. When we do kaparas, we often try to make sure there's a place where the Sheikhtim can take a break, there's a place they can rest, there's a place they can take a drink, someone's looking after them. Because when there's a lot of stress, it's hard to do a proper Shechita. The other problem that we have with kaparas is that chickens are out all night, sometimes in the freezing cold, depending on the weather. That is not healthy for the chickens, which could affect the actual kashrus of the chicken. There are people that are holding the chickens, they have no idea how you're supposed to hold the chicken. So when they hold the chickens, that could actually cause the chicken to become a trefer. If you don't know what you're doing, you could mess up your chicken. So there's a number of issues there in relation to kaparas, which are different than the ordinary. So if the chicken wasn't shechted properly, it depends what that means. There's a difference between a vela and a trefer. If the shechted, when you shechted the chicken, it was a fluke, a miss. He actually didn't shecht properly. We call that an avela. And in such a case, the kaparas, the key issue of kaparas wasn't done, because the key thing of kaparas is the shechita of the chicken. Especially according to the Kabbalah, according to what Alter Rebbe writes in the Siddur, the main thing is the shechita. So if it was an avela, the shechita wasn't done properly, either there was a problem with the knife or the way the shechita was, in such a case, there would need to be another kaparas. And the shechit might, most probably, will tell you, if you're there when they're doing the shechita, person is not there during the shechita, he should assume that the shechita was okay. But the person is there during the shechita, they shall say, shucks, it wasn't good. So then you got to do another one. And most places that do kaparas allow you to go get a free another kapara if it was a due to the mistake of the shechita. However, if the chicken turned out to be a trefa, when they kashrut, they discover it's a trefa, that's not a problem. Because you did your proper kaparas, you did everything properly, it was a proper shechita, and then sometimes it ends up being trefa, sometimes not. Sometimes it was trefa right from the beginning, right when the shechit gets it, he could tell you even before they open up inside to check what's going on, he could tell you it's a trefa because we see that you broke some organs in the chicken the way you were holding it. So then obviously we shouldn't give it to the shechit, the shech will tell you that right away. But if the chicken, everything was fine, and later when it was inspected after shechita, you don't have to worry, the kaparis is fine. Moving on to the day of Erev Yom Kippur. There's a mitzvah to eat on Erev Yom Kippur. We don't have too many mitzvahs of eating in our Torah, other than mitzvah of eating matzah, mitzvah of eating karbonos, and mitzvah, according to some opinions, that mitzvah esses deraisa, other opinions maintain it's not menat Torah, it's just from Chazal, but it's hinted in the Pasuk, a mitzvah to eat on Erev Yom Kippur. And Sfarim tell us, Alter Rebbe brings this in the Siddur as well, that it's a mitzvah to eat as much that you eat over 2 days. Now, that's a bit unpractical to eat in one day, what you would eat over 2 days is extremely hard to accomplish, but it doesn't necessarily mean literally. Eating more than what you eat one day, so there's what you eat on a regular day, and then eating more than that is already considered one and a bit is considered two. But most importantly, there's an issur actually to fast. And some people say this applies not only the day of Erev Yom Kippur, but the night as well. Now, there's specific things in the menu of Erev Yom Kippur that we're supposed to be eating. So generally, you're supposed to be eating foods that's easy to digest, and that applies throughout the day, even in the morning, foods that are light to digest, because we don't want a person to be full, which creates a feeling of satiation, that creates some type of arrogance. When it comes to Yom Kippur, the person is full because he ate heavy foods. You're not supposed to be eating heavy foods. Nothing to do, the doctors might tell you the same thing from a nutritionist point of view, but this is a halacha thing, independent of the nutrition aspects. That before a fast, it's good to eat light. This is an order that Yom Kippur, you shouldn't have this feeling of feeling full, which is not an appropriate feeling for Yom Kippur. So the examples are brought, fish, chicken, in contrast to beef. And that, so that applies even in the morning. Another thing it says we're not supposed to be eating. Hello? Another thing that we're told we're not supposed to be eating on Erev Yom Kippur is shumshum and sesames, because sesames are myla gera. They sometimes come back up, and therefore that's shouldn't be done on Erev Yom Kippur. We shouldn't eat food that increases semen production. Examples that are brought are garlic or egg. Garlic egg are out of the equation on Erev Yom Kippur. So egg, people eat normally eggs for breakfast. That shouldn't be done on Erev Yom Kippur. Now, although milk, butter sometimes is included in those types of foods that are marbe zera, that increase semen production, we're told that's not a problem in the morning of Erev Yom Kippur, your coffee in the morning, besides the fact that the milk in the coffee is very, very minimal, in addition to that, you can have your cereal with milk also, which is more milk. It's okay to have milk in the morning part of Erev Yom Kippur, but not in the afternoon. Because normally we eat two meals on Erev Yom Kippur. There's a morning and afternoon meal. In the afternoon meal, the meaning is that we don't eat fish. Even on the morning, it's okay. Even though fish is considered an example of a food that's light, and we eat it in the morning, but we don't eat it in the afternoon. And by Suda Mafsekas, there's a minig, it's not brought down in halacha, the minig that Rabbeim told us we eat foods without salt. And there's a number of reasons, and the simple reason is because to eat salt before a fast is not a good idea, it makes a person thirsty. I don't know if that means without salt completely, because having salt, food that's totally bland might be very difficult to eat, and there's a mitzvah to eat, and be very hard to eat, but certainly shouldn't be salty, that's for sure. Also, we eat an Erev Yom Kippur kreplach. So there's a question, which I don't know why nobody raised this in earlier Sfarim. How do you actually make kreplach? You put meat and you wrap it around with dough. But we're not supposed to be eating beef, meat, heavy meat. We're supposed to eat only chicken. So it's one of two things. Either you have to make a kreplach with chicken, which I don't know if it fits in with the Kabbalah of kreplach, whether the Kabbalah, meaning the traditional, and the Kabbalah, the mystical aspects of kreplach. It's not so simple. Or alternatively, and the alternative solution is that since kreplach is really, really a small, tiny piece of meat, we're not worried about it. I haven't seen this question asked in earlier Sfarim, how the meaning of kreplach came about. Traditionally, people usually make kreplach with meat, not with chicken. But on Erev Yom Kippur, could you do one of those? One of those, both of those options are legitimate. Erev Yom Kippur, one of the things we do in the afternoon is malchus. Now, we dafka makbid, our meaning is dafka to be particular based on that. Rizal Malkus is before mikvah. So although we do a lot of mikvah in Erev Yom Kippur, that's part of our tshuva process, both tara and tshuva, both to purify ourselves and tshuva, there's differences in halacha, which one is the real reason for the mikvah Erev Yom Kippur. But we don't do mikvah before malchus. We dafka want to make sure that the order is malchus and then mikvah. So yeah, you could go to mikvah in the morning, but the afternoon mikvah, before we go to the mikvah, the meaning is to do malchus. And that's why you see a lot of times in the mikvah, there's a line before people go in to do malchus. And that's based on a pasuk, banu ba'esh uvamayim, that we make sure we have the fire before the water. The mikvah is the water, the malchus is like the fire, so we do the malchus then. There's specific halachas and minhagim, how the malchus should be done. The malchus should be, the person should be facing north, based on the pasuk that tzafa mizav yasa. The Yetzirah is called tzvaini northern, so the person should be facing north. And he's laying on the floor, laying tilted somewhat on the floor, and then his back bent over, and 39 malchus is given. When it comes to fasting, so the number of halachas associated with fasting. Strictly speaking, in halacha it's brought that 11-year-old boy or girl should really be misane umashlim lechanche b'mitzvahs. We have a concept of chinuch in all mitzvahs. And when it comes to Yom Kippur, the law of chinuch doesn't apply the same way for a number of reasons. And one of them is because chinuch only applies not to eat food, which is forbidden, but the food is kosher. But the time is a problem, like eating before Kiddush, for example. So we don't train kids in that area, or at least where it's causing the kids pain, and we're pain and causing him. Asra la'anoisit al tereb, it says, you're not allowed to afflict the child and tell him, don't eat because it's not Kiddush yet. Because causing him affliction. I mean, obviously, if it's right before Kiddush, you should wait till after Kiddush. So we don't use chinuch in those areas. And the same thing when it comes to fasting and kippur. However, when he reaches the age of 9 and up, we have something called tainus shoris. Over there, we start training him into the concept of chinuch, slowly fasting more than he normally eats. Now, a bit later than he normally eats. He normally eats 9 o'clock in the morning, so I'll go an hour later, he'll eat at 10. Once he hits the age of 11, then the chinuch wants us, the aspect of chinuch is, the rabbanon, he should be fasting all day long, misana u'mashlim. Mashlim means he completes the fast. Again, according to the original strict halacha, part of his chinuch. However, there's a second opinion that says, no, not only an 11-year-old child, even a 12-year-old child, and even a 12-year-old boy, well, 12-year-old girl certainly would have to fast, she's bas mitzvah. But a 12-year-old boy, is sana'i's mom, a year before is bar mitzvah. Not only 11-year-old, but a 12-year-old also doesn't have to fast. Now, what's the halacha? The halacha is that when it comes to a child which is weak, nar kachosh, v'toshosh koyach, a weak child who is not exceptionally strong, such a child, we rely on the second opinion, and therefore, since it's only a Drabbani, he's not obligated in a Torah to fast, and therefore, since he's not Bamitzvah, we don't make him fast. Now, Alter Rebbe says that the minig became that nowadays, Eimidaktikim, we actually not particular about this halacha altogether. So while originally the halacha was that it's two opinions, and a weak child, we're lenient. Nowadays, we're not particular at all, because nowadays, everybody learns Torah. That's a positive thing, we're saying that everybody learns Torah. Torah makes people weak, therefore we assume the typical child is considered weak, and we don't make him fast, even if he hits 12. Number one. Number two, we're in a time which yard the chush shel olam. The world has gone weaker. People have become more weak today. People are not capable today what they were capable in the years of the past. Now we know this in many other areas. People today have a much harder time fasting. So therefore, today, we're not even makbid, even a regular child who is not typically known to be weak, we're not particular that he should be fasting at the age of 11 or even at the age of 12 with a boy. A girl at the age of 12, like we said, has to fast. Unless we know a child is bari, v'chazek, lizbel, healthy, good, solid, sturdy, a capable child, yeah, then we'll have him fast when he's 12. So, in summation, the minig is today not to make a child fast. A lot of people have tried to get their kids to fast at a younger age, and honestly, I don't see what the tales of that is. And when it comes to older people that are ready by Bas Mitzvah, fasting is the primary aspect of the Yom Tov. When it comes to the younger children, it's important they should be trained not in the things that they could show off to their friends and say that I was able to fast, but focus on their davening, on the tshuva. Again, if a child is body with chazak lizbel, if he's healthy and fine and there's no concern of sakana, then it's okay, you have to start at the age of 12. Women, which are obligated to fast as well, they start their fast earlier than everybody else. Once they ben shlich, they have to start fasting already, because by then they've already accepted Yom Tov. As soon as they say Shechiyonu, they've accepted Yom Tov. Even when they ben shlich, ordinarily they accept Shabbos and Yom Tov, but they could often make a t'nai. They can make a stipulation, they don't want to start Yom Tov. But if you say Shechiyonu, that automatically that means Yom Tov has begun, and once Yom Tov has begun, the fasting begins. Now, let's just go through a number of things about fasting and how it relates to women or to people that are expecting women, nursing women, etc. So this is a question that comes in a lot, and I have to say that in years gone by, it didn't come so much. And people are often asking, I'm pregnant, do I have to fast? I don't know where this mistake crept in from. I'm talking about Yom Kippur specifically. Yom Kippur is a fast which is biblically obligated to chiyuv min haTorah, and the only dispensation for fasting on Yom Kippur is for someone who is in a state of potential sakana, danger. A woman who is pregnant or nursing is not considered a state of sakana. I'm talking about obviously a low-risk pregnancy. So a woman, ordinarily, even if she's expecting, would have to fast. Unless her pregnancy is high risk, and if you have a question what that means, you can consult her of, or she's fasting and she's getting dizziness, severe headaches, dehydration, anything like that, that's a whole different story. If you see there's any serious concern, that changes the dynamics altogether. Now, there's a number of things that women could do when they're pregnant to help them fast. First of all, practical things. If they reduce their caffeine intake before the fast, I'm not talking about on Erev Yom Kippur, but even already a couple of days before, because this addiction to the caffeine makes it very, very hard to fast. If they drink before the fast, a lot of drinking, so this will cause them not to be dehydrated. If they make sure they're in an air-conditioned room, not overly air-conditioned, because that could also cause problems, and generally not to be overly active, which is a good idea in pregnancy in general, but specifically when fasting, if you have a choice to stand or to sit, sit. Sit or lay, lay. And bechlal, being positive and upbeat about it, trachut d'zayga, makes it much easier to fast. Likewise, when it comes to nursing women have to fast as well. But they should make sure to drink a lot before, because in order to be able to nurse, so if they'll nurse a lot, then they might become thirsty, which will make it very, very hard. So they should drink before. Another option is to pump milk before. At least some of the milk could be bottled milk, which is pumped before and warmed up in a way that's Mutar Yom Kippur.
How are you?
So if it's done in such a way where they use pump, and some, if they're already giving them solids or they're giving them other supplements or the bottle feeding them not from their own pump milk, Adrava, it's certainly a good time to do that. Now, if there's obviously any type of danger, then they're allowed to eat without a question, and they can assess themselves if they feel it's a danger, then she'll go running and ask a shaz. They believe there's a concern of danger, they can go in and eat. A woman during active labor is allowed to eat and drink as well, and they should talk to a doctor, because some doctors are discouraged eating during active labor. They want you to drink and be hydrated, but they don't want you to eat. That's already a purely medical question. But absent those considerations, generally pregnant or nursing women should do fast. What's very important here, and that applies to all people, that it's much more important, the fasting, than any other aspect of the day. So even if that means not going to shul, and even if it means lying in bed, and even if it means hardly davening, then that will enable you to fast, you should do that. That says in all Sfarim, it's already written by the Chassam Sofer, the Rebbe explains it in a letter as well. The Chassidish explanation, why the fasting is the most critical aspect of the day, because that affects the guf, and the most important thing is the body. But that's it's an important principle, that the fasting is more important. If a person knows, I'll go to shul, and therefore, because of that, it'll be hard for me to fast. Don't go to shul, obviously. If I'll daven so much, I'll daven less. And also, the husband should help the wife. A woman that's pregnant has a very hard time. She has to look after the kids, so he should stay home from shul as well, in order to help, so the wife should be able to fast. Now, when we're talking about breaking a fast, it's something called shiurim. And that's often misunderstood, and I want to explain that now. When we tell people to break the fast, generally we tell them not to eat a regular amount, but we tell them to eat small amounts of in a certain time frame, which is called eating shiurim, because the Torah, the punishment of karis that says in the Torah for somebody that chas v'shalom violates the isser of eating a Yom Kippur, does not apply if a person is eating less than the requisite amount. So although it's still asur min ha-Torah, even chatzi shir asur min ha-Torah, even if a person doesn't eat the full amount that the chayiv kares, it's still biblically forbidden. But when a person is faced with a choice where they have to eat anyhow, so they rather remove themselves from the higher concern of eating a full shir and going down to a lower level of eating, which is eating less than a shir. The shir is, for eating, it's two-thirds of an average-sized egg. The volume of two-thirds of an average-sized egg is in one interval. We'll talk in a second how long those intervals are. And in drinking, it's a mouthful. So what that means in practical terms, before the fast day, someone wants to measure how much they're allowed to drink, if they're allowed to drink, that is, at one time. They fill up their mouth with water, completely, both sides. Then they spit it out into a cup, and they take that cup and split it into half. It's really one cheekful is the amount, not a full mouthful, but the way to measure a cheekful properly is very hard to measure a cheekful. But when you fill up your entire mouth, and then you spit it out, and then you divide it into half, then you know how much a cheekful it is. Now, so once you have it divided in half, you have it in a cup or whatever it is, you make a mark, and then you keep it on that cup, a line, and you know you can fill up this cup up until this line, and that's considered the amount that you're allowed to have in one go. You can drink, a person that's allowed to, like we said, break their fast, can drink as much as they need to. But just a question of not doing it all at once. And they're going to take breaks. We'll talk in a second about those breaks. When it comes to eating, it's the shear is, we said, two-thirds of an average-sized egg, the volume, of, not the weight, but the volume of an average-sized egg, which is 30 cubic centimeters. I don't think that's going to help much to people if I say 30 cubic centimeters. But to put it in more practical terms, it's approximately the amount that fits in to a small size, small matchboxes. Whatever fits into that, you can eat in one go. And then take a break and eat more. Now, those breaks are, depending on the situation, ideally they should be 9 minutes apart from one time you eat to the next time you eat, or from one time you drink to the next time you drink. You could eat and drink in the same interval, because eating and drinking doesn't count. But eating and eating does join together. So you eat tiny bit less than the matchbox size, and then you wait the 9 minutes. If 9 minutes is impossible, then go for 7. And if 7 is impossible, go for 6. And if 6 is impossible, go for 4. Like I said, this applies to eating and to drinking. Drinking is more lenient, but generally, usually in most cases that we see, almost all cases that we see, it really is not a problem to wait that amount of time, because they're drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking. They're just taking their time in between. It usually is not a problem. People who break their fasting in Kippur don't make Kiddush. They don't use Lech Mishnah. I should mention, if they are going to break their fast, if they do have to break their fast, it's better to use energy drinks than plain water, because that will give them extra energy. There's a machlokas if they say Yalavoy, they shouldn't say Yalavoy. it seems that the Alter Rebbe's opinion is that they should say Aviyavi, even though he doesn't mention this in the Siddur. But if a person didn't say Aviyavi, they're not going to bench again either way, but they should actually should say Aviyavi if they're eating on Yom Kippur, if they wash, that is, if it's some bread. When it comes to Pikuach Nefesh, we have a general rule. So although it's important if a person has a question about Pikuach Nefesh, about whether they have to fast or not, they should ask a Rav. But when it comes to a Pikuach Nefesh situation, where you're faced with a person's faced with a Pikuach Nefesh situation on Yom Kippur, they shouldn't run asking Shilas, they should right away act on it. And that's why it's important to learn the halachas before, so we shouldn't have to go and ask Shilas. The expression used, that if somebody asks a Shilas about Pikuach, when it comes to Pikuach Nefesh, he's a Shaif of Dam, he's considered a murderer, because he's going and asking questions about Pikuach Nefesh, when now it's time to act and not to ask. And during the time that he's going to, till he finds the Rav, that could Chas HaShalom be alive. And Hanishal Harezim Maguna, the rabbi who was asked, is considered a negative thing for the rabbi who was asked a question, because he's at fault that he didn't teach his community the importance of Pikuach Nefesh. So in order that I'm not faulted with that, make it very, very clear, if there's a question of even a suffix, Pikuach Nefesh, on Yom Kippur, don't ask any shalos, follow the guidelines we said before. A person who's supposed to eat or drink should not, Chas HaShalom, go against the Rav's instruction. He's not fulfilling Hashem's ratzon by fasting. On the contrary, when he's eating, he's fulfilling a mitzvah. The same Torah that says to fast on Yom Kippur is the same Torah that says this person is doing a mitzvah when he eats a Yom Kippur. And that's we discussed the concept of Pikuach Nefesh over the last few months relating to the pandemic. And it's a very, very important concept that we don't do mitzvahs because we appreciate to do them a certain way. We do them because that's what Hashem wants. If Hashem wants us to chop wood, we chop wood. And if he wants us to eat, we eat. To drink. He wants us down with a minion, with a minion. If he tells us that it's not the right thing to down with a minion, down without a minion. We don't own the mitzvahs. We're not doing it for ourselves. We're doing the mitzvahs for Hashem. Moving on to other halachas about Yom Kippur. We spoke about fasting. I'm going to move away soon. We're going to get back to the other inuim, the other afflictions that we have in Yom Kippur besides eating and drinking, but I just want to go back to Erev Yom Kippur. So there's a meaning that in Erev Yom Kippur we light a lebedig licht and a neshama licht. And there's also a matzi Yom Kippur licht. And again, just to clear up some confusion about these various different lichts, let's make it very clear over here. Let's try to make it clear. There's a meaning that anybody who's married has what we call a lebedige licht. And that's a licht for people that are alive, that's for married people, and that licht is in the shul. Again, this is our meaning, we don't keep it at home, we keep it in the shul. It's put to this someplace where they put all the licht. A lot of people don't want to know where the licht is, because the concern if it goes out, it might be considered a negative omen and not a positive sign. So they just give it to the Gabi, to the Shamas, to whatever it is, or to someone else. You put my licht, I don't even want to know which one is my licht, and somewhere in the shul, ideally it's supposed to contribute to the illumination of the shul, but some shuls have a practical hard time to have the licht, all the lichts in the shul with so many people going around, so they put in a side room or whatever, but that's the ideal thing. Then there's something called the neshama licht, and that's the people that have parents that passed away. And generally speaking, if a person has two parents that passed away, one licht would really be enough. Obviously, if there's a husband and a wife, then there would be the husband has parents that passed away, and the wife has, they would have individual licht. The Rebbe's minig was he did neshama licht for every individual parent and even relative that passed away, but that's not necessarily halakhically required. In addition, that neshama licht is actually kept at home. So the lebedig licht, the licht for the living people, is brought in the shul. The licht for the people that passed away, that's kept at home. There's an addition to that, there's a third licht, which is we need to make sure we have a licht for Havdalah. The halach is that the candle that we use for Havdalah is supposed to be called a Ner Sheshavas, a candle that rested throughout Yom Kippur. In other words, it was a whole Yom Kippur, this was burning, and now, and there was no malacha done with it, and now we're using it on Matzi Yom Kippur, because Matzi Yom Kippur, the Ma'ira, we make a bracha Ma'ira Eish, but it's a different type of Ma'ira Eish that we make on Matzah Shabbos. This is to acknowledge the fact that we couldn't light a fire throughout Yom Kippur, and now we have fire which is available for us. So the halach is when it comes to this licht that we use on Matzah Yom Kippur, it's supposed to be, the easiest thing is to prepare a special licht for that purpose that we just have in order that we should be available for Avdallah. Now, the neshama licht, which we have at home, or if someone even has, for some reason, they kept a levet licht at home, that is not kosher to use for Matzi Yom Kippur. And the reason is because the licht for Matzi Yom Kippur is supposed to be a ner, which was lit lahoyer, a candle which was lit for giving us light, and not lekoved, and not something which is done for honor and respect. So if we're going to use the neshama licht, that was used lekoved, that wasn't used lahoyer, we can't actually use the neshama licht. So the easiest thing is we set up a special candle, and this candle will be used purely for Avdallah. What we could do is, we could take the neshama licht, light another candle from the neshama licht, and then make a bracha on the new candle that was lit from that candle. So the original fire is what we call an Ner Shoshanas. It was burning from Yom Kippur, and no malach was done with the Yom Kippur. That's the original fire. The new licht is not done the covered, it's lahoyer. I put up a licht for Avdol, now I'm watching Yom Kippur. I lit it from a neshama licht. But since it's an Indian to go and dafkit, there's a chumra dafkit to use the actual fire, not to light something else on that fire, to light the actual fire, Shoshavas and Boyd Yoyim Mamish. So what people do is they light another candle from the Ner Shoshavas and they use both. That's what's commonly done. That's in relation to discussing the licht. One more thing that we have to prepare on Yom Kippur is there's a minhag of Birchas Habanim that people give a bracha to their children. Somebody asked a question, what do we say about Birchas Habanim? There's no official rule what we're supposed to say. The Rebbe did say Birchas Kohanim. That's a pretty strong indication for us what the right thing to do is to say Birchas Kohanim. The Rebbe spoke a number of times that if we want to give a bracha, the best bracha to give is the one that the Torah uses. We might as well use the Torah's bracha even though we're not Kohanim. Now people add to that bracha, they give a bracha for Chesim Toiv, etc. Brachas v'shiduch, that's all fine, but the Birchas Kohanim is what's commonly done. It's a mitzvah of Yom Kippur to say, starting from Erev Yom Kippur and continuing on to Yom Kippur, mitzvah of vidui. There's a number of rules about vidui that are very important. Vidui is supposed to say, we said, standing. Vidui is the alched, the ashamnu, standing. People are not supposed to lean when they're saying vidui. Certainly if it's a leaning, where if they lean so much, then even though Yom Kippur are fasting, it's a bit hard to stand. But if they lean in such a way that if you're going to take away the table, well, full, that's considered leaning. Every time a person says vidui, this is a rule that's supposed to be said standing. At the same time, it's recommended to bow somewhat during vidui like moedim. So position, it's not critical. It's critical to stand, but it's not critical to bow. But if a person could bend slightly, that's better. People are supposed to clap on their chest when they're saying Hashamanu, when they're saying Al-Khayt, when they're saying Al-Khatayim, when they're saying Slachlanu, etc. Now, when people are saying vidui in their shtil Shemin Esra, whether on Erev Yom Kippur or throughout Yom Kippur, so people take their time and say their vidui, and sometimes it hasn't already started Chazar Sashatz. So you're allowed to answer the following things in Chazar Sashatz. You are in the middle of your Shemin Esra, but your sort of vidui is in middle and after. You finish Shemin Esra, but you still didn't go out the three steps. So you're allowed to answer the following things. You're allowed to answer in Kedusha only the Kaddosh Baruch and Yimlech. You're allowed to answer the words Moedu Anachnu Lach. You're allowed to answer Amen only for two brachas, the most two important brachas to answer Amen in Chazar Sashatz. In fact, it's so important that it's important to wait and not start Shemin Esra if you might miss to answer these Amens. Amen on the bracha of Amelech HaKaddosh and Amen on the bracha of Shmei HaTfilah. And if a person went so far in his vidui, it's taken him a very long time, and Chaz is already up to Kaddish, he's allowed to answer only for the Amin, the two most important Amins in Kaddish, Amin Heshmir Abba, and Amin and Amiram Ba'olma. That's the negative vidui. We said I'm going to go back to the halachas of Inui, of the five Inuim. There's five things that are forbidden on Yom Kippur, because the Torah says we're supposed to afflict ourselves. We mentioned already about eating and drinking a lot of details. I'll just mention that the halach of eating and drinking is even a mashu, even a tiny bit of person's not allowed to eat, like we mentioned earlier, but you're allowed to touch food. A person who does have to eat, like we mentioned earlier, will have to wash his hands if he's eating bread. Unless they're eating shiurim, then they don't make a bracha on the Tulsi Daim. If they're eating an amount that requires either kazayas in the right amount of time, they will bench, and then, like we mentioned earlier, they will say al yavan. Generally, when it comes, I didn't mention this earlier, but I'll throw it in now. Trying to go in order, we missed out this detail before, that the general principle when it comes to Yom Kippur, like I heard from a Rav once, nish sufil machmer zayin, nish sufil mekel zayin. Yom Kippur one has to be very, very balanced. It's a scary balance. Yom Kippur is kares, it's quite extreme, so we don't treat leniently fasting Yom Kippur, but pikuach nefesh is even more extreme. So it can be overly lenient or overly strict. But in addition to the isra of achila, ashtia, there's one of the inuim is rechitza, you're not allowed to wash Yom Kippur. Washing a person is not allowed to wash even a tiny bit, even if it's to remove sweat. Not allowed to wash his mouth. However, a person is allowed to wash if their hands became dirty with mud or some other type of dirt. You're allowed to wash the area that became dirty. And that includes, somebody threw me a question here, that includes even using soap. A person could use, if their hands are dirty, could use soap, liquid soap that is, not regular soap, which is a problem anyhow on Shabbos, but they could use liquid soap. Some people are machmir, they don't use liquid soap even on Shabbos, and they try to make it more liquidy, add water. Okay, if you machmir like that every Shabbos, it could be the same in Yom Kippur. So you're allowed to do that. You're allowed to wash, like I said, with liquid soap. Likewise, when it comes nowadays, when people are washing because of hygiene, because of corona, and they want to wash their hands with alcohol, whatever it is, there's no problem to do that in Yom Kippur if it's an issue associated with COVID. Again, only the minimum that's required, and that's it. If a person touches an area which is a covered area, which you normally have to wash your hands, then they should wash their hands until the edge of their fingers, like on throughout Yom Kippur. Person goes out of the bathroom, so it shouldn't be a shiloh of whether they're allowed to wash or not allowed to wash. So they should touch a covered area, and then they wash again till the edges of their finger, not the full hand. Before davening, a person is always allowed to wash, even if he didn't touch any covered parts, because he's standing right now before davening. It's just a good idea when we're talking about washing, when we go by night to sleep, and people prepare negelasser, I always recommend to people they shouldn't fill up their entire negelasser, because if they fill the entire negelasser, they'll forget in the morning, they wake up, they're half tired, they'll just wash their entire hand. So if you wake up in the morning and see a negelasser not totally full, it'll remind you that you're not supposed to wash your full hand. People wash twice, the same way they wash throughout the year. People wash once right at Negev Asra, and then after they go to the bathroom and make Al Tel Zidayim. Yet they can do that in Yom Kippur too. Again, we're washing it for Ruach HaTumah. We don't do the whole hand, that we can do a Matzim Kippur, but it's okay to wash twice. If the same thing as throughout the year, if a person who makes it in the morning is less to go to the bathroom and then make Ashi Yatzar, to wash once for Negev Asra, and then again afterwards after the bathroom. And Kohanim washed their full hand on Yom Kippur. And actually washes a hirada that they gave, even there's machlokes apaska about it. They wash their full hands again after Yom Kippur, even though they wash their hands on Yom Kippur. It's a special extra hamshacha after Yom Kippur. When the nukadosh of after Yom Kippur comes on, they need to do a proper washing afterwards. The other one of the inuim is sicha, that we can do Yom Kippur, is anointing ourselves. So a person can anoint themselves with oil, with creams, even a mashu, even a tiny bit, even to remove some type of zuama, some type of dirt. But a person is allowed to do anoint himself with refuah, but for medicinal purposes. But obviously, only in those ways, they're allowed to do that on Shabbos and Yom Tov too. So it depends on the type of cream it is. It depends if you're not supposed to shmir, you're supposed to dab it, all the regular rules that you do on Shabbos and Yom Tov. And again, we're talking about when it comes to COVID and there's a concern of a contagious infectious disease, you're allowed to use a cream too, but you really don't have to because you could use liquid soap, liquid alcohol, which is much better from a Yom Kippur point of view. The next one of the Inuim Yom Kippur is Ni'ilas Hasandal. People can't wear shoes. That means leather shoes, even if they're covered with leather. Unless somebody is, it's a woman within 30 days when she gave birth, someone who's sick that they can't wear other kind of shoes, somebody has a problem with their feet. But now there's very good replacement, other types of shoes, which are equally, they can accomplish almost the same thing as regular shoes. So, therefore, all these coolers don't really apply. In some people, almost every single Yom Kippur class, this question about wearing Crocs in the street in a place where there's no Erev, if there's no back. So, the halacha is a person may walk in the street with slippers or Crocs or any of those things, even in a place where there's no Erev, even if it doesn't go up on the street and doesn't have a back, as long as it sits well on his foot and it doesn't slip off. There's no problem with Pelach to wear that. What we do have a problem is often the strap in the back of the Crocs rips. And what happens is happens often in the middle of Yom Kippur, and the strap is now hanging and only connected with on one side. So it really achieves no goal, no purpose. So you're allowed to wear it on Shabbos in a place that has no edim if you're not planning on fixing it, and you're not planning on taking the strap and using it for something else. So the strap becomes totally butl, and that's not a problem. But if you are planning on fixing it, so now we have a problem. The strap has a function, and you're carrying something which is has for you a purpose. It's a chashuv thing for you, but right now it's not serving a purpose, and you're carrying it via Yeshu. Then it becomes a problem, and you really shouldn't go with such kind of crux on Yom Kippur. What you'll do, whether you'll walk barefoot or find someone else to help you out, sleep in the shul, I'm not sure. But even Reb Chaim Noah writes that the people are not careful about this, and as he brings various different ways to be melamed tzchus, why people are not careful about this. But again, the strict halach would seem to imply that that should not be done. The other halacha of the five inuim Yom Kippur is Tashmash Shamita, which applies to married couples. They have to keep all the regular harchakas, the way they always keep during time of Nida, night Yom Kippur, day Yom Kippur, all of the harchakas throughout from each other. Children should not be wearing shoes. We shouldn't put them on shoes, even if they didn't come to the age of chinuch. We don't wash our children. We don't anoint them. You don't have to stop a child who does this on his own, but we don't do it to them. Once a child reaches the age of tainis shoyis, and he's supposed to start fasting somewhat, a tiny bit, then you're not supposed to give him to eat, you're not supposed to give him to drink, you're not even supposed to put food in front of him. And if he on his own eats, you're supposed to tell him, no, you shouldn't eat, you have to wait another hour. A thing which is not very well known, because it's not printed in the Machzor, some of the numer zayim was printed it. The night of Yom Kippur, when it comes the time of Shkia, there's a mitzvah to say vidui again. So there's a shita of the Ramban that says that the main mitzvah of vidui is right when Yom Kippur comes in. It's not a halacha, but it's a shita of Ramban, and it's brought down halacha that we should be concerned with his opinion. And if even though we said vidui in Erev Yom Kippur, that's the halacha, that is the time of vidui, Erev Yom Kippur, and the next time we'll say Al-Khayt again will be the night of Yom Kippur by Ma'ariv, but the Ramban maintains that the Ikra mitzvah's vidui is dafka when Yom Kippur comes in. And if a person sees it's becoming Ben Ashmashes at sunset, he should right then go and say vidui Hashamnu Al-Khayt, etc. And another thing which was negated by night is what I spoke was before Kol Nidre. Usually in most shuls, they start Kol Nidre later, after Shkia. Later after Kol Nidre, the Shechianu and Shul, the Rebbe asked particularly to publicize this because a lot of people make this mistake that people that bench licht on Erev Yom Kippur and said the bracha of Shechianu, woman who said Shechianu on Erev Yom Kippur should not say Shechianu again on Shul because it's a bracha ratola, they've already said Shechianu before. Matzi Yom Kippur. I'm up to Matzi Yom Kippur. We spoke about Abdullah. There's a minig that the Friedrich Rebbe brings. Well, let's go before Abdullah a second. I said the other day in the shir that there's a major, major change between Ne'ilah. There's an extreme difference between Ne'ilah and Ma'ariv on Matzi Yom Kippur. The same difference that's between the chuppah and the wedding. That Ne'ilah is absolute seriousness. All of a sudden, it's like a ratze in a shir. Comes the time of Ma'ariv. Ne'ilah people take their time, and they have them slow, and they cry, and they do tshuva, and they scream, Shema Yisrael, Hashem, Elokim, all of a sudden comes to Ma'ariv, whoa, people are running. And different people, it might have started at different times. Some people, it's during the Nine Kapitlach, some people, it's after the Nine Kapitlach. The Rebbe once spoke about this by Fabrengen, it was actually after Yom Kippur, Fabrengen. It was a Shabbos Bereshis Fabrengen, in the year Tav Shin Nun. I was there by the Fabrengen, and the Rebbe spoke about the fact that he goes about this strange thing. You just finished Ne'ilah, the Rebbe said. You said Avinu Malkein, you said Shema Yisrael, you announced the Shana Abba, you did it Ki Gedoyla, and such a matter, where's your rush to eat? The person's supposed to be poil on himself. You should be in such a situation that at the end of Yom Kippur, you don't think about eating. Are you eating yet? Because the Torah said, Lech HaChol B'Simcha L'Achmech, it's a mitzvah of the Torah, but not because of the geshmak of fooding, of the food. It's a Yom Tov. So you're eating because it's a Yom Tov. There's a mitzvah actually to be Marba B'Suda, on Matzi Yom Kippur B'Archov, we make a big meal. Some people say it's a school for Parnassa. We eat dipped bread and honey, etc. And there's a special baskel that goes out and says, Lech HaChol B'Simcha L'Achmech, we wish each other good Yom Tov. But not because we want the food. You just had a whole day of in shul. So before we even get to the food, even my Maida could take our time. It's the first Maida right after Yom Kippur. Take our time. The problem is that the shul is running fast, so it might be time to daven Marichas and Abitzibur. After Maida, we have, if we can, then we do Kiddush Levana. But after Kiddush Levana, if we do, when we're doing Havdalah, or Havdalah, then Kiddush Levana, depending on what's going on in your shul, there's a meaning that the Friedrich Rebbe brought that people should dafka do Havdalah themselves on Friedrich was makpid dafka do Havdalah himself on Matzah Yom Kippur. And the second thing is that he said that in Matzah Yom Kippur, you're allowed to give, usually we don't give the leftovers of Havdalah, we never give leftovers of Havdalah to other people to drink. Matzah Yom Kippur, it's okay to give the leftovers of Havdalah to other people to drink. I don't know the reason for this. This is something that we know from the Friedrich Rebbe. Very negay that if a woman is home and she can't wait for her husband, she's fasting and she wants to make Havdalah herself, even though normally women don't make Havdalah, she can make her own Havdalah, she can use grape juice, she can use tea, she can use coffee. And if she doesn't know how to make Havdalah, then she should go back to school. But either way, if she doesn't know how to make Havdalah, she's allowed to drink water before Havdalah. According to Allah, you're allowed to drink water before Havdalah. We're very makbid about that. And if she needs to, she can even drink seltzer, which is like water. And if you really press, she can even have a tea or coffee, but not with sugar or milk. But really, she could just make Havdalah herself. The Eibush will help. Everybody should have a Ksiv Chsim Teva. Ksiv Chsim Gemar Chsim Teva. We should have a Shnaz Gula V'Yisho. We should have we're talking about Yom Kippur, but we're still heading to Rosh Hashanah. Yom Kippur actually is called Rosh Hashanah in Tanakh. And we should have only Besudas Teva, Rosh Hashanah, Shnaz Gula, Shnaz Yeshua, and the Riker. Oh, there's a few questions coming in now. Okay, now that we were formally trying to wrap this up. How many candles should a girl light besides for Yom Tov? I'm assuming we're talking about a girl, we're talking about a single girl. So a single girl lights only one candle for Yom Tov. And if she's living alone, then she needs to have a special candle for Havdalah, like we mentioned before. But other than that, the Neshama Licht is only if somebody lost a parent. A Levitic Licht is only for someone that's married. So if the girl lost a parent, she'll write a special candle for the parent, besides for the one lift that she lit. And if she did lose a parent, she still needs to have a candle for Havdalah to be ready to a 24-hour candle for Havdalah. Someone asked me a question about suppositories. So the strict halacha is that one may use suppositories on Yom Kippur. But place can say one should not do it. For a range of reasons, they say that it goes against everything that Yom Kippur stands for. But if a person needs to, a Tylenol suppository or even a caffeine suppository for some people, which they really can't without that, then it's definitely mutar al pi halacha.